This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Health and Living, and you're listening to an edited recording of the first panel session at this year's Health and Living Live 2022 by AIA Vitality. On this panel on long COVID, Tisha Oik spoke to Professor Datin Dr. Nurlina Mohamed Ibrahim, consultant neurologist at Hospital Chancellor Tuanku Muris, and Dr. Helmi Hajamaidin, head of the Lung Centre at Pantai Hospital Kuala Lumpur, where they shared the latest updates on the impact of long COVID, as well as treatment and rehabilitation, particularly when it comes to the lungs, brain and nervous system. They were also joined by Revati M. Murugappan, a long COVID patient herself who shared her challenges in getting her symptoms diagnosed and what kind of support patients need from those around them. This event was presented by AIA, enabling healthier, longer, better lives.
I have been very interested in long COVID as well, and I've been very confused by what I've been reading online. You read so much about people saying they have such debilitating symptoms, chronic fatigue and things like that, but at the same time, not getting any answers from healthcare professionals. And then you hear about all the organ systems being affected. You know, you hear from the brain to the lungs to issues like diabetes, and I'm wondering, how can all this be possible just from one respiratory infection like COVID? So hopefully we can get the answers from our experts here today, or at least to give us some clarity on how we should move forward. If millions of people have had COVID, what does that mean for them if they do develop some symptoms of long COVID? Is it all doom and gloom? Or can they get support and therapy and get back on their feet again? And you know, what would be the most current knowledge from research? So, Revati, if I could start with you, because there's nothing like hearing from somebody who is living with the issues. Perhaps you could take us back to when you first had COVID. How severe was that infection? What you went through?
Okay, so I was one of the unfortunate ones who had the Delta strain. It was at the end of November last year. I have no idea how I got it. I am a fitness person, and I was actually conducting a yoga retreat, a wellness retreat in Terengganu. And on the last day of the retreat, I started vomiting and I started getting diarrhea. And so the journey from Terengganu to come back from Kuala Terengganu, what would have been a 4-hour trip, turned out to be an 8.5-hour trip, because I vomited and had to stop for diarrhea breaks all along the way. I do have an underlying stomach problem, irritable bowel syndrome. So I just assumed that perhaps it was something I ate wrongly. You know, Terengganu is filled with seafood, and perhaps I may have eaten something, you know, that didn't agree with my stomach. So that's why I was vomiting and having diarrhea. But anyway, I got back home around, you know, 11 something at night and just went to sleep. The next day I felt really tired, and the vomiting stopped, but the diarrhea continued. So I went to the doctor, and the first thing I asked her was, because I looked wiped out, doctor, do you think it's COVID? And then when she, you know, assessed me, she said, I don't think so. I didn't have fever. I didn't have anything else except gastrointestinal symptoms. So very, it's a presenting symptom, but it's not a common symptom. So she said, okay, I'll, you know, she said it's not necessary to do a PCR. Just monitor your symptoms for 2 days. And if it gets worse, okay, go straight to the hospital emergency and, you know, get tested. This was on a Sunday that I came back from Terengganu, and Monday I went to the doctor. Tuesday, I actually felt fine. So I did my workout as normal, okay, and I thought, okay, it must be a stomach bug or whatever, okay. So I thought everything went off right. Wednesday, I woke up feeling very, very uneasy. I got up and I collapsed. So I didn't know what was happening. My heart was racing. I just felt like I wanted to vomit, so my family was in the house. And I told them, please wear a mask, because I don't know what it is. And they didn't. They said, no, it's in your stomach. Anyway, after collapsing a few times, I decided I think I better go to the hospital. So I called my gastro and I said, I have this. And then he says, okay, come straight to the hospital. It was a private hospital. And so I went to emergency, only to be told there were no beds. Okay. So now what do? I'm like this, you know, I can't take anything. You know, I'm running to the toilet, they're helping me. So then I ended up anyway going to University Hospital. And just my luck, at the emergency, the doctor told me there's going to be a 2.5 hour wait because look at all these patients. So anyway, they gave me a bed and put me in the corridor, and so I waited. So to cut the long story, the gastro team that came and checked me said it's probably acute gastroenteritis. Nobody said it was COVID because I didn't have any presenting, you know, any cough, any fever, nothing, right? Okay, he said, you know, we'll just do some bloods and then we'll find a room and we'll find a bed, hopefully, and put you there and do your PCR test as per the hospital SOP. Okay, so when the bloods came out first, he said your inflammatory markers are very high. So he postulated that the inflammation was coming from my stomach. So anyway, they put me on drips and got a room. The next day, I was told it's COVID positive. So now they're thinking whether my problem is related to the stomach or is the symptoms part of COVID. But they made a decision to put me in the COVID ward. I was there for about 10 days because they just couldn't stop the diarrhea. I was very, very weak, and that's when I lost my sense of smell. I had a terrible headache, and then I developed a fever. But I still had no cough. They did my chest x-ray. Everything was clear. My lungs were clear. But I was having very bad palpitations and, you know, just breathless. Obviously, I couldn't get out of bed. So they categorized me as category 2 based on the fact that I didn't have any lung symptoms. But if you had based it on my stomach, as one doctor told me, it'd be category 5 because I was just in bad shape. So anyway, because COVID is a respiratory ailment, so they're looking at your lungs. So when I was discharged, nobody told me that I needed rehab because what would the rehab be for, right? And the doctor, and when you have COVID and you have diarrhea, they will tell you not to take the diarrhea pills because the diarrhea will stop the virus from getting out of the body. So I couldn't take any diarrhea pills. And post-COVID, my diarrhea continued for 6 weeks. It was just a nightmare when I think about it. So 2 weeks after I was discharged, I was just in bed. My heart would be beating really fast. But they did all the ECG in University Hospital and they said, you know, we can't find anything wrong. You just have to give it time. 2 weeks of lying in bed, and then I decided, I called my gastro, and then he said, come, maybe the IBS has been triggered. Okay, at that time, he had not seen any post-COVID patients, so he started treating me for IBS. Let's just assume it is. All right, and, oh, I must tell you that the worst symptom that I had was the nausea. Until today, it's still there. It just completely felt like vomiting, you know. Okay, so then he gave me all kinds of drugs for the IBS, and only maybe 30% of it worked. And after that, he didn't know what to do. And then he asked me, because my heartbeat was very fast, have you thought of seeing a psychologist? And I was thinking to myself, you think it's in my head? Really? And I started doubting myself. Maybe it is in my head, right? Well, I mean, I take my hand up and my heart rate is 118. And you're looking at someone, I'm not bragging or anything, whose resting heart rate is 53. Right, that's how fit I was.
Gravity is a dancer, I must say. So,
so he said it must be. He didn't say it's in your head. He said, "Have you thought about seeing a psychologist?" Then I said to myself, "You think it's in my head?" Then he said, "No, look at all this trauma that you've gone through, and maybe that's, you know, causing you anxiety." Yes, I admit there was some anxiety, and I'd be lying if I said there wasn't. Okay, fine. Saw the psychologist, and so she said, "Part of it is anxiety." She said, "Part of it is not." So very quick sessions, because I think I know my body very well. So I had 5 sessions. And so that part, that fear had gone. But the tachycardia, the fast heartbeat was still there. Still, the diarrhea was presenting itself. And I didn't know what to do. So am I going to be sick like this? Which doctor do I see? And I'm also a journalist. I'm a health journalist. So I am in touch with a lot of doctors. And many of them I asked. Everybody said a different thing. But nobody knew how to address the problem, because they were not looking at post-COVID in December and January, right? So I went from one doctor to another. I saw a sports medicine guy, I saw this fella, I saw that fella, I saw infectious disease, all my friends. And finally, in February this year, I was scheduled to teach at a fitness marathon, and the organizer was the University Hospital, University of Malaya Medical Center. And so when they asked me, how are you feeling? I said, I don't think I can do this 4-hour marathon. I can barely do exercise for 10 minutes, right? How can I do this 4-hour marathon? Then he said, never mind, come. Let's do a VO2 max test. That's a volume of oxygen test that you do either on a cycle or, you know, standing or whatever, and they strap you on with this device. It's like a stress test, but only think you are strapped in your mouth where they're measuring your oxygen uptake. And I failed within the second level from 1 to 2, which is like maybe 5 minutes, my heart rate went up to 167. And he was like very shocked because he knows me as a fit person. What is happening? He said, something is not right. All right, something is not right. But you know, at a government hospital, you can't see the next specialist immediately. You have to wait. So he said, you come back next week and we will do further test. Anyway, by the time next week came, I had other things to do because I still have to work, because who's going to give me MC, you know, month after month, right? And nobody could tell me what's wrong. Which doctor do I go to? And then I was just very fortunate that one of the persons that I was interviewing was a rehab physician. And she was talking about, you know, long COVID rehab, all right? And everything that she said ticked the boxes for me. And then in the end, I shared my story with her and she said, you know, you poor girl, you've been struggling like this and nobody has told you to go for rehab? I said, no, I didn't even know what rehab to do because everybody said my lungs were okay, right? And then when she heard my story, she said, come for assessment. I think you need to be admitted, you know? And I said, admitted? Because I have so many things going on, right? I mean, so basically I was very lethargic. I was having diarrhea. You know, I was having fast heart rate. With the mask, I can't breathe very well. You know, when I sit up for 10 minutes working, after that I have to go and rest because I'm just like, you know, just drained and I just didn't know what was happening. Anyway, she said you have been admitted for, we suggest a month so that we can do this multidisciplinary, we have a multidisciplinary approach. But then I'm thinking, the cost, all right, who's going to cover this cost for me? Because
This was in a private hospital,
right? Because the government hospital, they are only doing inpatient rehab for their very bad COVID patients on oxygen supplementation. And since I was not on supplementation, there was no cause for rehab. Anyway, to cut a long story again. Okay, so I ended up not going, not being admitted because I went for assessment and that particular doctor said, you don't need to be admitted, just come maybe twice a week to start. That twice a week to start was already too much for me because that one session of rehab, all right, would put me out for 1 week. I couldn't get up, literally cannot get up. Okay, then they said, okay, just once a week. And I tell you, it's just so easy exercise, just from sitting to standing, 5 times. And then I rest for 10 minutes because my heart rate would have soared. All right. And then one or two other exercises. And then the spirometer. The first time I did the spirometer, the doctor told me, look, my 93-year-old mother-in-law has better lung capacity than you.
Oh, dear.
You know? I was like, oh. But I said, but doctor, my lung x-ray is clear. But she said, your lung x-ray can be clear, but the function is not, something is not right. So I'm still doing the spirometer, so it's been 6.5 months, and I am much better, thankfully. Thankfully, I found rehab. I can only thank the lucky star, so I'm still panting like just now, the exercises. I couldn't do all of it because it just, my heart was pumping already, and it's very, very frustrating. It's very frustrating when you want to exercise and you are an exercise person, and then now here you are, like what's happening to my body, you know?
Thank you for sharing that, Revati. I mean, I saw you attempting to do quite a lot of the exercises and, you know, just looking at the capacity of your body, and I can see the dancers, you know, agility there. And, you know, I do hope that you get it back, the fitness.
You are listening to an edited recording of the first panel session at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality. We'll be right back after this break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. This is an edited recording of the first panel session at this year's Health and Living Live 2022 by AIA Vitality. Here's the second part from that session on long COVID.
Tell me if I can turn to you. So what is this thing called long COVID? How has it wrecked somebody like Revati?
The short answer is nobody knows for sure. I warned Shawik before the event. I was like, there's a lot of things that we don't have a specific answer for. There's a lot of things that we don't know for sure. And I think everything you've shared is very emblematic of the issues that we faced, both in terms of like face-to-face consultations, but the system as a whole as well, because there's a difference between issues you face in the acute setting. So for the first couple of years, it's been very much sort the emergency out. There's a fire. Let's, you know, get rid of the fire. And no one really thought about what's happening to the people who suffered in the fire, whoever has been suffering in terms of their housing, their finance, their actual physical well-being. But even like long COVID itself, there are literally more than 200 symptoms that have been described as being part of long COVID. And generally, people view it as something that has persisted beyond 3 months. Now, there are different types of manifestations of the disease. So like you pointed out, in your case, it was primarily gastrointestinal. You mentioned in passing whether it's a respiratory infection, why does it affect everything else? So the mode of transmission is through the respiratory tract. But like many viruses, the impact can be very systemic. So you may start having things pass from one to another through droplets, through aerosol, but at the same time, the impact on the body is very systemic. And that's one of the core sorts of theories at the moment as well, where there is a feeling that your body goes a little bit haywire. You know, whenever we have an infection, the body will respond in a particular way. It produces certain types of things called cytokines. They produce certain types of reaction, which causes inflammation. And one of the key concepts behind long COVID, where people feel very tired, very drained, very fatigued, is that the system does not stop. You're constantly switched on. And this is something that a lot of studies have identified as being a key factor as to why people feel the way they do. I think approximately 50% or so of people feel this fatigue. And one of the biggest challenges is it's a very subjective thing. If you go to 10 doctors, there is no way for them to kind of say, is she getting better or not? There's no way, no objective measurement like your lung function test. Your lung function test, when you breathe, it tells you how good or bad your lung strength is. But that alone doesn't tell you how you are feeling very fatigued as an individual. And even when you breathe, it's not just about whether there is any damage to the lungs itself, but the muscles is a key factor in how you breathe. So you breathe, for example, primarily from the diaphragm, which is a muscle. So if you have muscle fatigue, then of course your diaphragm will be affected and you will start to feel breathless, and that's not easily captured. So when you don't capture something easily, then you can see how it's difficult to treat something properly, how to identify a problem, how to do studies on it, because everyone's doing things very differently. And then you'll end up seeing doctors or healthcare workers who think it's all in your mind because I can't find anything wrong with you, so therefore something is wrong with you upstairs. And it's a rather paternalistic kind of lazy way of dismissing something that we don't understand. And I think one thing that COVID has taught us is we need to be very humble in our knowledge. Whether it was COVID itself or even long COVID, we have to recognize what we don't know and look into these issues that we don't know. And as time went by, then we start to see certain things that do work. So for example, rehab. So now almost every other person, if you've got issues with long COVID, then you're wanting to address that through rehab. But one key thing I'll mention just before I end is not everything that you suffer symptom-wise after COVID is because of long COVID. So when someone comes to see me, the first thing I want to do is I want to rule out any other conditions. Just like in your case, the IBS masked your symptoms, or rather, people attributed the symptoms to your IBS. Then it was, is the IBS making things worse, or is the virus making your IBS worse? And that applies to many other conditions as well, like heart disease, for example. If someone's got underlying heart problems and they develop chest pains or difficulty breathing, you can get, for example, myocarditis or inflammation of the heart when you're infected with COVID. But at the same time, if you have underlying heart disease, then it can trigger your angina. So you have to make sure that whatever's underlying has also been adequately addressed and you're not missing out on anything. So one recent example I've had is a guy who's been suffering since December, and it was only last month that he had a more thorough investigation and we found out that he had infective endocarditis, which is an infection of the heart. So I don't think, on the one hand, we must not dismiss long COVID. On the other hand, we must not be quick to place the blame on it every time we see a patient who is not getting better.
But I think that's why, Revati's sharing of the rehab perspective finally helped her to get to that point to get answers, because rehab looks at things from the functional, and it's not about looking at scans, it's not looking at test results per se, but it's looking at, well, if you used to be able to do this and now after this long period you haven't been able to, something is not right, and you know, what can we do to get you back on your feet, right? And we do have two questions here on Slido that I would like to use to lead into to you, Prof. One is, how does COVID and long COVID affect the brain? And we've been hearing about things like brain fog, just not being able to think as fast or be as mentally agile as you used to, being very forgetful. But also another question was How do you distinguish when it's long COVID and when it could be aging issues? You know, among the older adults, they do attribute some of this cognitive slowdown to aging. So perhaps, Prof, that view of what you're seeing when it comes to the brain and other neurological issues.
Okay, thank you very much for the question. Thank you, Rebati, for sharing with us. Yeah, the issue of long COVID, how it affects the brain, it I guess it's a spectrum. You have a very mild brain fog. I would consider brain fog as an inability to be mentally flexible. You lose your mental agility where you are unable to switch from one task to another. And I find that too. I mean, it doesn't have to be with COVID alone. Sometimes as we get older, we lose that mental flexibility. What COVID does is it taps on certain predispositions that the patient has. For example, Revati had IBS, and so the main symptoms that she experienced was the gastrointestinal symptoms. For somebody with perhaps a sinus problem, the main symptom would probably be a sinusitis. And similarly, somebody who may have underlying cognitive issues, maybe as they age, they may have, you know, the COVID may unmask that. And not to say that everybody who has mental fog or brain fog have underlying cognitive difficulties, but I'm just saying that it could unmask an underlying issue. So this, what are the neurological features? To answer the question is, there can be headache, there can be anosmia, a lot of
anosmia is
a loss of smell, mm-hmm. loss of taste, ageusia, loss of taste. And that could persist for longer. When anything that persists longer than 3 months, that's considered as long COVID. So again, there's a spectrum, and it's a mild brain fog, severe one. So what we see is we need to rule out, as Dr. Helmi pointed out, we couldn't just attribute everything to just post-COVID, that's it. You need to investigate. Sometimes we may need a scan, we need to follow up the patients. Will they recover? Most of the time, the mental fog would recover with, you know, some patients may not require rehabilitation at all. Some patients that require recover on their own with exercise, you know. Normally, I mean, data shows that these long COVID symptoms, which are mild, would recover over time. And that's the good news. Aging really would unmask certain things, but it's hard to know which one contributes. So that's the short answer.
But over time, how long? And I'm sure that's something Revati is wondering. How long?
Helmi
is trying to think, how do I say we don't know in another way?
Yeah, actually, it's very individualized. I would think we don't know. I would agree with Dr. Helmi. We don't know how long it'll take. But I would like to give a positive message here because data shows that patients recover over time. This is data from our hospital, Sungai Buloh Rehab, which actually received the largest post-COVID patients, and they, in fact, in the last year, they've treated up to 7,000 patients. And the shared by the head of the rehabilitation specialist that over time patients would recover, but some patients may require rehab, some don't. It's just that we need to make sure that they get into the rehabilitation early if they require it. Please.
I'm just going to say it may be difficult to say for certain for the individual, but as Prof was saying, as a whole, the majority of patients do recover and do well, especially after 6 months. And by 12 months, you're talking about more than 90% of recovery. But it's difficult to say for the person in front of you that you will be okay in 6 months because we don't know which pathway or which spectrum the individual may lie in. So from an individual perspective, it's very difficult to guesstimate. But from a community or from a cohort point of view, you can say, you know, that certain amount of percentages will get better.
But also, for a population, you say 6 to 12 months sounds optimistic. For Revati, you tell her another 6 months of this.
I think I sort of accepted it because it's been 6.5 months now, and I can see that maybe I'm about 50 to 60% better. So I, hopefully in the next 6 months, I will be 100%. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk a little bit about sort of like support, and especially from an employment perspective. I think, you know, getting employers to understand this is something people are struggling with. But we do have a question about scarring in the lungs. You know, somebody said, my doctor said, I had scarring in my lungs after COVID. I've recovered from COVID itself, but should I be concerned about that? And I also wanted to add, you know, these kinds of
effects on the organs. And, you know, there are studies showing that there's some shrinkage to the brain as well. Are these permanent?
You mentioned just now about how you were not deemed to be a category 5 because they didn't look at the, or rather they were only looking at the lungs. So that, the reason for that is because the thing that most doctors would be looking at or be very, I suppose, concerned about is the oxygen levels, because that's the one that essentially kills people fastest. So not to take away the experience from other systemic symptoms, it's because those are the things that in the acute setting, so once again, these are all when you're in an emergency setting, the first thing they look at is there anything on the x-ray? Is the oxygen infected? Yes, no. And that helps the emergency department doctor or the initial doctor in a way put you in ICU or not. That's what determines whether you go into ICU or not in the in most circumstances. But if you get to a point where other organs are affected, then of course you start to have other symptoms, you start to suffer in other ways. The reason lungs are particularly susceptible is because that is the entry point. And in a lot of cases, you may not feel anything. I'm in that category of I have no idea if I had COVID or not, because you know you had sniffles every now and again, but testing may be negative. But once again, in a very small number of people, you can develop symptoms, you start having respiratory issues, you can develop pneumonia, which is inflammation in the lungs. And depending on how severe that is, you may have complete resolution, but in some cases, even after you have recovered from the acute infection, you will be left with scars. It's like a wound. If you have a small cut, and if you're younger, then you're more likely to recover fully without having any issues at all. But if you have a bad wound, a bad burn, and if you're elderly and you've got other issues affecting your the health of your body, then you may not recover as well. You may be left with a scar. The problem with a scar in the lungs, though, is the part of the lung that has that scar is not going to efficiently bring in oxygen into your body or breathe out carbon dioxide. And the level to which you have that scarring is going to determine the degree to which your breathing is affected. So if you have a little bit of a scar, it's not going to be anything of any concern. You may have something on the x-ray, but then if you breathe normally, you walk normally, you talk normally, then there's no issue whatsoever. But if the scarring is significant, then of course it may have an impact. And this is in some ways a separate entity from long COVID itself, because this is something that you have you suffered as a consequence of the acute events, and as a consequence you've got these complications which are treated differently and viewed differently. I'll pass the brain shrinkage bit to Prof.
But also, would that kind of scarring be reversible eventually?
No, unfortunately not. So in the acute setting, by acute setting, I mean in the initial stages. So when you're sick, when you are in hospital, when you're being given treatment, the pneumonia, the swelling, it goes up. So the x-ray will look whiter, it looks worse. Now, a lot of that will improve if the medication works, if the patient is improving. But then you may be left with that residual scarring. And that residual scarring may be with you for life.
And impact on the brain itself. You know, I mean, we've talked about the symptoms, but it's terrifying if you think about the brain, because we're already worried about degenerative conditions like dementia. How do the effects on the brain itself progress over time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Actually, we don't know. There are some studies that has shown that their brain shrinks after COVID, and there are higher incidences of Parkinson's disease as well in patients post-COVID. But we don't know whether we think that the COVID unmasks or accelerates what has been predisposed in that individual, if you understand what I mean. For example, there is a predisposition in a person to develop cognitive impairment or Parkinson's disease already, but it doesn't manifest until at a certain age or unless they are hit by another environmental trigger. And COVID may be that environmental trigger that actually leads to the degenerative process. And it doesn't affect everyone in that sense. So only those who are predisposed. So most of the patients would recover. Hopefully they don't have brain atrophy. But animal studies do confirm that there is a higher risk of neurodegenerative diseases post-COVID. For adults, we really need long-term data. We're only 2 years into the pandemic. And I have seen patients who present to me with Parkinson's disease post-COVID, and it's hard to tell whether it's due to it Where is it a double hit hypothesis or what? So we still need more data.
Another population we're concerned about is children. Can children get long COVID and what would that look like?
Yes, they can be affected as well. And I think a lot of the studies looking at the etiology or the cause of long COVID is actually being done in children. There's a gentleman, I can't remember his name now, in Italy, who's doing lots of studies into whether or not they may be developing microclots, whether there's a degree of inflammation. And there is this rather, in a way, scary condition called, I always forget the letters.
MISC.
That's the multi-inflammatory system disorder in children, which basically in plain English is things go inflamed in kids. And this is something that, for reasons that we're not quite clear yet, does not necessarily only impact children who've got your category 4s or 5s. So you may have very mild category 1, category 2 type COVID symptoms, and then a few weeks down the line they develop this sudden inflammation which can affect any part of the organs. And that's kind of one of the key drives behind why we've been pushing for vaccination amongst children, because although, once again, if you look at things as a whole, percentage-wise, you don't really get the same levels of complications in children compared to adults. When it does happen, it can be fairly significant. So you're wanting to try and reduce the potential for these things from happening, because once again, when it happens, we are stuck in a situation where we don't clearly know what's going on. We know there's inflammation. We don't know what's driving it. We don't know why some kids have it, why other kids don't. And all you're doing is you're treating the manifestation of those underlying issues rather than identifying what the cause is in the first place. So once again, new areas of research, people are looking into it. A lot of it boils down to dampening the inflammation.
Yeah, so could we treat long COVID by addressing the inflammation?
We believe it will, because a lot of the treatment options being looked into at the moment are still very much in studies. So there's no specific treatment like Paxlovid. You know, you've got COVID, you give this tablet, there's an 80% chance that you won't develop complications or death. We're not at that level of interventions yet. The studies ongoing do find that giving steroids, for example, in some patients are helpful. But once again, because the cause of it is not too clear, and I think I should take a step back as well, we are assuming, or rather we have assumed so far, that long COVID, or we've talked about it in such a way that long COVID is one entity. And actually, we may be actually dealing with multiple different entities or etiologies or multiple different cases that's triggered by the virus but may have different kind of consequences to the body. And each one of those entities may need to be treated differently. And that's why when you look into the studies into what's causing it, there are slightly different findings depending on the research groups. And one thinking is that actually you're not dealing with just one disease as a whole, but different types of diseases where, once again, you may be dealing with inflammation, you may be dealing with microclots. So when I say microclots, there is some suggestion that part of the reason why organs don't function as well, why sometimes muscles are fatigued and are more tired than usual, is because there are tiny clots in blood vessels that are preventing good flow. So then, with that theory in mind, there are studies looking into whether anticoagulation or giving blood thinners are going to help with the outcomes. But because we haven't reached a stage where we are sure, then it's not something that we can automatically prescribe and say for certain is going to make a difference.
And you're right that it is just presenting in so many different ways. I mean, just looking at what's coming in through Slido, some people are talking about hair loss, losing their sense of taste and smell, as you mentioned, Revati, feeling that fatigue and laziness, putting on weight as a result of that, just the ripple effect. So, Prof, for instance, I know at HUKM, you are dealing with patients who come in with a variety of issues, but, if they are essentially almost different diseases, what should patients do? Revati herself talked about this convoluted journey of going from one doctor to another. Is that going to be the pathway for people who have these post-COVID issues?
For post-COVID issues, I guess the moment, I think people are becoming more aware of this post-COVID syndrome now. Because in the beginning of the pandemic, as Dr. Hilmi pointed out, we were more worried about the mortality, the acute management. But the chronic management, we weren't sure. We don't know. We don't know how, we didn't know how it was going to affect the patients. But now, as more people are being affected worldwide, in the US, in Malaysia, we have 4 million affected, and about 10 to 15% would suffer long COVID symptoms or post-COVID syndrome. Some may be mild, and it is irrespective of the categories of COVID. So even mild categories can suffer from long COVID. So how do we address that? To answer the question is that when they present to the healthcare doctor, the doctor must be aware if the patient has had recent COVID infection within 3 months and they have lingering symptoms, that should alert the health professional to kind of, could this be a long COVID syndrome that the patient is suffering? And I think there are a system in place, actually, where they can go to the primary health clinic if they suffer such symptoms, and they have a pathway for patients to be referred to rehab. And I hope we send the right information that Malaysia has had a pathway for this. It's only when the patients come to hospital with acute management. So it's very difficult to kind of tackle that because your symptoms is very, very atypical, Revati. It really, really mimicked acute gastroenteritis without any fever for some time. So that threw everybody off. But although having said that, I think at the time of the pandemic, we were aware that there could be patients who could present with gastrointestinal symptoms. And that should be something that we always think of. And now we are relaxing. We are not swabbing patients unless they have respiratory symptoms. That's just a standard protocol because we have moved to endemic. And if the patient developed new respiratory symptoms, then we swab the patient. So we may discover COVID later, especially if the symptoms are atypical.
So it does seem there's a very, very fine balance. Like you said, Helmi, you don't want to attribute everything to long COVID or post-COVID issues. And you also want to be sensitized enough to pick up the post-COVID issues.
You're listening to an edited recording of the first panel session at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality. We'll be right back after another quick break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. This is an edited recording of the first panel session at this year's Health and Living Live 2022 by AIA Vitality. Here's the final part from that session on long COVID.
Perhaps just a little bit looking at the rehab and, you know, the sort of like functional therapy perspective. Revati, if you could share what kind of rehab you've been going through, because I think that would be especially just for those of us who don't understand this aspect of treatment from the functional perspective, how has it helped you?
So basically, they're talking about physical activity. You know, just now I pointed out sit to stand. They teach you to do that, all right, just 5 times. I think the most important thing in rehab is, as they keep telling me, it's all about pacing, all right? You don't want to wear yourself out. So walking on the treadmill, 5 minutes. Actually, it wasn't even walking for me. It was seated on the reclined bike and just cycling, just very low, very slow. And that would fatigue my muscles already. So after that, 5 minutes of that, 5 to 10 minutes of rest. Okay, and then proceed to the next exercise. So in an hour, there could only be 3 exercises because there's a 5-10 minute break in between. And finally, they'll put me into the spirometer and ask me to breathe maybe 5 times. Okay, and that would tire me out. I'll get chest pains. And then I lie down there. So yesterday, since I'm on to my 8th session of rehab now, my therapist said, okay, let's try 1 minute of slow jog. And I did, and that killed me. Just 1 minute, and I was out for half an hour. I was lying there because my heart rate had soared to 145. Still not 100%, but I was feeling really tired. You know, just that 1 minute. Of course, I have to admit that it wasn't quite a slow jog because in my head, this athlete mentality, you know, what is the slow jog? Come, let's pick up the pace, all right? So I went a little bit faster, but just 1 minute. And I'm supposed to do that every day. So that rehab sort of helped me. So they keep emphasizing the fact that I need to pace. So if I do work, that's also mentally, it's still working my mental muscles. I need to rest after 1 hour or half an hour, right? And because I'm working at home, I can do that right now. But when you are in the office, there's no way that you can go and take a 10-minute break every 1 hour.
Well, I don't see why not. There are lots of people who take breaks for cigarettes. From your perspectives, you know, when you refer patients for rehab, and I think I'd be especially interested in maybe starting with Prof first. What does rehab from that cognitive and neurological perspective look like?
For cognitive rehab, it depends on the severity of the patient. So if the patient just comes with, usually when they come with this mental fog, when we do the mini mental state examination or the cognitive assessment tool, it's actually normal. So patients don't actually have any problems. But when you do a detailed neuropsychological assessment, they have problems with executive function. So for that, we can advocate occupational therapy, where they do mental flexibility or mental agility exercises. General exercise would help as well. So, I mean, that is dependent on your fitness level, and it has to be slow and paced, depending. It varies from individual to individual. So I guess for mental cognitive rehab would be like that. We have to refer. And who do we refer will depend on the severity. In most cases, the patient may be able to manage on their own, except when it is the requirement of the job, when they are really affected by this mental, you know, inflexibility or the brain fog, and that really affects their task as a lecturer, for example. You know, they have problems and they really couldn't find the word and they stop mid-sentence. But I think that occurs to everybody. Everyone has that. I mean, just because you cannot find the words, it doesn't mean you have cognitive difficulties. It's fine. It's just that when it's really off balance and it's getting very severe and progressive, then we have to pay attention. If it's getting better, just leave it. It might get better. We could refer you to rehab, or we can just monitor. That's it.
All right. We have to wrap up. I just want to address one last question, because there are a couple of the similar ones that came up on Slido, and I think this is a great opportunity for us to lobby a little. Does insurance cover, long COVID treatment as well as rehab? To your knowledge, as you're treating patients?
I can pass the mic. As far as I know, no, but I think it's also because a lot of it involves investigations. So getting someone through the process of investigations can be quite tricky.
Yeah, and I wanted to bring this up because the issue is so complex, and that as you are learning more about it, and that's where the communication with the stakeholders, I feel, can continue and can broaden, and because largely symptomatic right now, I can understand why it couldn't be covered just yet. But as you learn more about the syndrome, Prof, from the cost perspective, treatment and rehab will add up to what patients have to go through, right?
Actually, the outpatient management, I think it is going to drain the patient's pocket, really, because rehabilitation, I'm sure Rebati can agree, yes, to that. And I feel very sorry, because that is the treatment. And if you deprive the patient of that treatment, and that's going to affect their life. And some patients could not afford it, and as such may not receive rehabilitation because of that. So there's something that we have to probably think about. But I guess we're talking about post-COVID. I just want to give a positive message that I don't want us to have all doom and gloom. Although it is considered a disability in certain parts of the world, you can claim for disability allowance, but there is hope. You can improve. We just have to be positive and get rehab early and be consistent. And if there are issues later, I think we can work through that with your physician.
Something final from you, Rebati?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, somebody asked a question about inflammation. So what I'm also doing is going for acupuncture, because that has helped. Of course, it's extra cost. That helped immediately get 50% of my nausea out.
That's amazing.
That has helped, yeah. It also helps with blood circulation.
All right. Yes, Ziwang,
Sorry, I thought there was a questions on insurance. In the desk of everyone questions, I feel obligated questions.
We will be so glad to hear from you, actually, yes, because this is part of what having the conversation is.
Fantastic question. I think this really on top of the mind. Ever since the pandemic came out, there were a lot of questions whether first COVID is actually covered condition, right? Because generally, pandemic situations, insurance doesn't cover. I've got to say, fortunately for AIA, I mean, we do cover, COVID as an illness, but is COVID hospitalization now? The question regarding the rehab and all those, if you're hospitalized and then, you do post-hospitalization treatment, that is actually covered. But today, if you're not hospitalized, but you go for rehab, I believe generally that is actually not covered. Part of the reason why is because, as you know, you hear from both Prof. Nolina and Dr. Elmi, the condition is actually very, very new. So there's a lot of unknowns, and every patient, and you hear from Ravati's stories, right, go through a lot of permutations. So it's really very difficult to determine where to start providing cover. And if things are very, very unsure, the chances are the cover is going to cost so much money that nobody is going to buy it anyway, right? So we do need to have a lot more data and information for us to be able to design products that will be able to cover now. So that's the only so much that I can share.
Thank you so much, Diwang. And I think that points to continued open conversations about what patients are going through, for doctors to be more sensitive about it. At the end of the day, what you want is that data to show the burden of the problem. I must applaud and commend Ravati for coming here to share her experience with us. It's one of the most harrowing ones that I've heard. And our wishes, I'm sure, are with you to continue to recover. And thank you, of course, to Dr. Helmi and Prof. Nolina for sharing their expertise with us.
That was an edited recording of the first panel session on long COVID at this year's Health and Living Life 2022 by AIA Vitality. This event was presented by AIA, enabling healthier, longer, better lives. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.